Sports, Sons of Anarchy, Incognito, Hip-Hop, Rock, Revolution, Marvel, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Orange is the New Black, Batman,
Call of Duty,
The Hunger Games,
Poverty,
New York,
The ATL, The Walking Dead, Girls.
Tune in to Look to the Cookie, now part of the Shootin' It Network.
Welcome to Shootin' It with Jamie K.
Welcome to Shootin' It with Jamie K. I am your host, Jamie Corrales, here with you for yet another episode, episode 41. And last week we had Alexandra Naughton on the show. She was a great guest. And that episode's been getting a lot of feedback. I noticed on the Facebook page, and on a couple of different Facebook pages, as a matter of fact, and Tumblr, there have been a lot of comments. There have been a lot of, you know, praise for her guest appearance, as well as, you know, just the show in general. So I'm hoping that we banked a couple of new listeners off of that one particular episode. Tonight we have yet another writer. So we've hit a mark where we've gotten three writers in a row, and four writers out of, I think, like five episodes. Tonight we have Ben Tanzer. He is a novelist and a podcaster. He wrote the book Orphans, and his latest book is called Lost in Space, and you can buy that right now on Amazon.com. And while I'm doing plugs, if you want to start your own business, go to shootinitpod.com/zoom, because LegalZoom offers you the fastest solution in terms of starting your own business. So why don't you do that right now? And you can run your own business. You don't need an Etsy account to sell your blankets or your quilts or your fucking pillows with little weird Star Wars snowmen on them. Start your own company online today. shootinitpod.com/zoom. All right, why don't I call up Mike and we'll get this interview rolling.
Hi, Jamie.
What have you been up to since the last episode, which was Alexandra Naughton?
Well, there was a comedy competition at the Comedy Stop at the Tropicana, and
where's that?
That's in Atlantic City, and I got banned.
Is this what you told me about earlier?
Yeah, so that's my highlight.
So why don't you just regale that story like you didn't tell me it already a couple of hours ago?
All right, well... it's like a comedy competition, and then before the competition starts, he's like, the owner is like an old comic, and he's giving us like this pep talk. Mind you, it's March, and he's wearing sandals, and he looks like Don Imus, and he sounds like Don Imus.
Oh, God.
So I couldn't take him seriously right then. And then what he's saying, he's like, they have to be clean sets, no cursing, don't say fuck, which doesn't make any sense because he, I don't know, fuck. Anyway.
He runs a clean comedy club, just you can put it that way.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't.
So hold on.
It's not a clean comedy club.
He was just giving you guys a hard time then.
Yeah, or just me. Just anybody that he didn't like. Anyway, he just gave us like random numbers. Like he just pointed to us and gave us a number. I was number six. So number four got done, and then they're like, all right, number five. And there's no number five. So what you're supposed to do is, like, once they call the number that's in front of you, you're supposed to go wait in the green room until right. He's done his set, and then you walk out. So in the green room, I was just going to prepare a little bit, because the only audience there is the people who are performing, and then, like, three judges who obviously don't really know funny.
How did they pick the judges? Who were they?
I don't know. One of them was his daughter. I don't know what she does. And then the other guy was just some... fucking shitty local radio guy with those awful tribbly fedoras you always see on Tumblr.
Actually wear those?
Yeah,
like, non-ironically?
Yeah, he was being like serious about it, and I was like, this guy is gonna tell me who's funny? Like, he doesn't know what the fuck to wear. Anyway, there was no number five, and then they were like, six, number six. And then I panicked, and I was just sitting, and then I just ran up there, so I didn't even prepare, so I was a little shocked from that. And then... you know, as he was saying in the beginning, like, oh, it has to be a clean set, I just said, fuck it. None of my set is clean. I can't work a clean set. So I was like, well, if I made it all this way for nothing.
Have you even written a clean joke before?
No, maybe. I have no idea.
Why don't you tell us one right off the top
of
your head?
No, I really am not going to do that.
Come on, tell us a joke, Mike.
No, fuck off. There's, like, no one here.
Not yet.
Yeah.
Anything? Tell us what happened. You really just kind of stopped right when you got to the action.
I was in the middle of this joke that goes, and like the main thing about this joke is like having a clean asshole. So I said the word asshole like 3 or 4 times, and then he just grabbed his microphone. He had a microphone too, and he was sitting in like the judge's booth. He was like, "Mike, Mike, Mike," and he was kept cutting me off, and my like bottom lip was quivering because I was so fucking mad. I was saying a bit. I was building up to the thing, and he just cut me off. Like not even a minute in, 58 seconds in. He's like, "Mike, it's okay." And I was like, "All right, I'm not freaking out. I don't know why you're telling me it's okay." Like I'm crying. It's okay. Like it's okay.
That's like that kind of like a weird passive like fatherly way of shutting you down.
And it's just like first, he's the worst. Anyway,
he sounds like a douche.
He is. He really is a dickhead.
But couldn't you have just replaced that with another one? Couldn't you have said like
no,
your butthole?
Even if I said butthole, it would be.
I hate the word butt in general.
It would be silly and stupid. So you have a clean butthole. See, it would sound dumb.
Yeah, horrible.
Anyway, he cut me off. He's like, "Mike, it's okay, but we don't need asshole jokes here." And I was like, I think I said, "Oh, you don't? I'm sorry." I just put the microphone on. And
Does he perform there?
I guess so. And then my friend and I, who like moved to Denver, he's like, "You want to just go down to the floor and get free drinks?" And I was like, "Yeah, let's go do that." And we left like halfway through. And of course, the people that advanced were like, one of the comics I like, and the other people that advanced were like an improv group. You're just like, oh, God.
And there was an improv group in the competition?
Yeah.
That seems a little, no, that ain't the same. Like that, how would they allow that? That makes no sense at all.
Well, the improv group, I can't say bad words, but he was making like a fake gun and shooting it into the audience. So you can pretend to kill you, but God forbid you hear an asshole joke.
Yeah, I don't know. America has like a warped fucking sensibility, not just in comedy, but of course on television and whatnot. It just across the board.
Just wearing sandals. Fuck him. It's March. It was like 30 degrees. Fuck you, Bob.
His name is Bob. Great. on that note, why don't we give Ben Tanzer, author of Lost in Space, a call? I know you have a lot of questions for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Why don't I have to like dial an extension number. With this guy. He's at an office.
Oh, God.
I don't think I've dialed an extension before. Let me
I dialed one today. It was number 1. Went to LensCrafters. Fucking $437 for my glasses.
Your hipster shades?
No, I didn't even buy them. I left after I heard that number.
Thank you for calling Prevent Child Abuse America.
Oh, God.
What?
Child Abuse America.
Oh, good God.
Crisis call. Please hang up and dial 1-800-422-4453. Prevent Child Abuse America is located...
What is this?
South Wabash Avenue.
Well, you need to prevent child abuse, Mike.
I don't want to be on this.
Speaking of child abuse, I found out just today that Massachusetts is the child abuse capital of the country.
40.
Yeah, you guys put that on your freaking license plate.
You know
right?
I don't like this. I don't like this computer talking.
Why don't I try that without...
it's a very rude computer. He clearly doesn't know we're talking here.
I don't think he knows how a podcast works. Okay, I'm removing that from the group.
Is that Ben?
What was that? Yeah.
Great interview.
And that'll wrap up the show for the night.
Thanks, Ben. You can catch him on, well, this number.
How's it, Ben?
Hey, how's it going, Ben? Welcome to Shooting It.
Hello.
Thanks, brother. So sorry about... Hey, man, sorry about the phone thing. That's bizarre to me.
Yeah, we had a little bit of trouble, but I'm just glad we finally were able to get to the interview. I should also warn you that my correspondent, Mike Malkiewicz, he's a stand-up comedian. He's with us tonight.
Hi. Hey, Mike, how you doing, man? I know you mentioned him in one of the messages. How you doing?
Hey, what's up, dude?
Good, I'm great.
So why don't we get right into things?
Are you getting like a weird, glitchy electronic sound, or is that just on my side?
That must just be on your side. You're coming in pretty clear.
Great.
If you can't hear anything at any point, just let me know and I'll repeat.
Sure, man. No, thanks again for this, dude. I really appreciate it.
Hey, no problem at all. So your latest book is Lost in Space. That came out a while ago, right? A couple of months? Or
actually, no. Lost in Space, the drop date was yesterday. We are 1 day into it. Yeah, no, the timing's crazy.
Yeah, I know. You sent me a galley a while back, so my whole timing was off.
Yes.
So you've written a number of books as well. Your Goodreads list is just out of control. You've written a ton. And you also have your own podcast. So what I'm most curious about is, what do you think, like, started you off on the path of wanting to become a writer?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I assume, which is the most cliche thing, and I apologize, I always read voraciously. So I think it started with that. And, you know, as I get older, I look back particularly on the experience of reading the Basketball Diaries by Jim Carroll and just being absolutely electrified by that. But I think it must have started there, this idea that maybe someone could do that, I could do that. Secondly, though, I realized, too, as I get older that, you know, I didn't have aspirations to write from a very young age. Like some other folks who come up on these interviews, I'm always very jealous of them. But when I was a senior in high school, I wrote a piece for a required class, not out of any particular interest in writing. And, you know, now I look back and realize that, you know, people really love that piece. And I'm sure the affirmation of that hung around for years. Because for most of my 20s, I kept thinking, I got to write someday, I got to get started. But it wasn't until around 30 when I really got going.
Oh, so you didn't really start, at least on a serious, more so professional sense, until you were about 30 years old.
Oh, yeah, no, not at all. And in fact, I hadn't even written a sentence prior to 30 since high school. I mean, I had done essays for college, but no, fiction, it had been about 12 years where I was thinking about it. So then I got started. And then, of course, once I got the first piece out, I haven't stopped in the intervening 15 years, but it was a long, I don't know why, man. I'm not going to give you a million reasons why, but it was quite a slog just to write that first thing.
You know, it's actually funny. You said that was a cliche answer. I've had a couple of different writers on the show, and most of them, they're not even really big readers. They just somehow get into that one way or another. A lot of them were actually more so into music, like writing lyrics down and just wound up kind of transitioning into poetry. You're actually like the first full-blown novelist that I've had on the show, so it's actually nice to talk to someone who's into fiction and not just, you know, straight prose. So you mentioned Jim Carroll as one of your influences, right, growing up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I was obsessed. I know, now that I'm a father, which ties into the book I just dropped, you know, it takes you to look back. I mean, I must have read the Basketball Diaries at like 10 or 11 and was just obsessed and always wanted to, always loved that sense of being able to write like that, real time, all electric. I mean, that's always linked in my brain.
Other than Jim Carroll, who are your other influences? And outside of writing, do you think that there were any people or, you know, television shows, movies, music, whatever it may be, that you think affected your writing and how you developed your voice as a writer?
Oh, yeah, dude, endlessly. That's a great question. I love that question. Yeah, I mean, the Ramones have been a huge influence. I think their ability to write really fast and sparse and slamming, I absolutely try to do that in almost everything I do, real time, you know, almost like a fight, even when it's happy. So that they're a huge influence. The director, David Cronenberg, is a huge influence, you know,
great
really.
Director, yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because I'm not super bizarro or speculative, though my novel that came out in the fall was science fiction. But I think the way he talks about his work, the intimacy and the violence, I'm very, very, you know, caught up in that. So he's also a big influence. Bruce Springsteen, which is funny because now that I'm old and I live in the Midwest, sometimes I worry that he sounds like more of a joke. But, you know, when I was a teenager, I don't think anybody wrote like him. Not the way he wrote, not the way he tells stories. I think people treat him a little more comically now. But, man, in the 80s and the 70s, and I'm really old, you know, he was really beautiful. I mean, there's other people, though. You know, Toni Morrison, not the most famous stuff, but that book, The Bluest Eye, that book absolutely, like, that was probably the first book as a young adult. There were many books that knocked me over. That was the first book where I thought, wow, that's what pain looks like. I'm on a page. I mean, that book really transfixed me. Dorothy Allison, Bastard Out of Carolina, absolutely annihilated me. Hunter S. Thompson. So definitely a lot of writers, but musicians too. As I said, the Ramones, the Beastie Boys for sure. I'm a mad Beastie Boys fan, and I think that mix of sort of pop culture and humor, and again, the speed. I love speed. You know, the idea of really trying to be sparse and write fast and knock people over. I feel like I want to be throwing punches the whole time. That's a big deal to me, trying to think like that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Good call on Cronenberg, by the way. He's one of my favorite directors. I got completely unrelated to anything else in the interview, but what is your favorite Cronenberg film?
So the last two, well, not the last two he's done, but there's these back-to-back ones, A History of Violence. Like, the early ones I love, but A History of Violence absolutely blew me away. And then he followed that with this Russian mob movie whose name is escaping me. And I love them both equally. They're both Viggo Mortensen. I love Viggo Mortensen. But A History of Violence was really transformative. It made me think a lot about my writing. He had a comment about that, sort of the he made a comment about the intimacy of violence when he talked about that movie, and I thought, yeah, I want to write like that. I want to write like he's talking. So those are late movies for him compared to the ones people talk about and love, and I love a lot of the early ones too, like The Fly. I love his remake of The Fly, but man, dude, The History of Violence is amazing. What's the other one? Eastern Promises? Is that the mob movie? God, those movies are so good.
Yeah, that, those are amazing. I think that's what you're thinking of, Eastern Promises. I'm actually, I haven't been as like big into David Cronenberg as of late. I'm really just a big fan of his 80s work, especially his body horror type films, you know, Videodrome and The Fly, for sure. But anyway, moving on from Cronenberg. So, again, you've written a lot of books. What is your writing regimen like, and how do you find time to balance that out with, like, family life and whatnot? Because I know you mentioned you were a dad before, and I just, I don't know, it boggles my mind.
Yeah, I got two boys. You know, I mean, first off, I always say this, which may not be interesting. I mean, I really try to treat the family and work. You know, I have a day job. I'm here now. Day is over. I'm hanging around. But, you know, I try to wrap the writing around that. And so the regimen, which is not too interesting or sexy, but the regimen is try to write every day, you know, slot out a minimum of 30 minutes every day. And I think you'll really be stunned. You know, it's kind of like running. I'm definitely a compulsive runner, too. I mean, I'm compulsive about everything. But, you know, things pile up, you know. And so if you can get in there 7 days a week, no fat. I mean, I don't sit there and this sounds like kind of a big comment. Yeah, you know, I don't usually sit there and stare at a sentence. Like, I am cranking every day for that time. Like, it's very manic. And so the main regimen is every day I try to figure out when it's going to happen, and then I do anything possible. And then, you know, if an opening arises, I've made this joke before, if my wife all of a sudden leaves the house with the kids, like on a weekend, even if I was in the middle of a shave, I would walk straight out of the bathroom and start writing. So, you know, part of the goal is that focusing on how do you turn it on and how can I turn it on and turn it off? And that's been a big driving force. And, you know, that turned out to be more doable than I imagined it would be. And I guess it's similar just to the ways I do other things. You know, it's like a lever. And that makes the biggest difference. I don't know what it's like to have hours. I've never had that experience. I've been working and fathering almost the whole time because I got such a late start. But, you know, the everyday thing adds up after a while. You know, when you do a year out a year, then it's not as impressive or interesting. But it helps. It helps. You know.
Yeah. So would you say that you're more of a writer who tends to, like, improvise as they go along? Because I feel like, I someone else said this, too. I'm completely stealing it from, I think, George R. R. Martin. He said that there's architects and gardeners. And the architects, of course, they, you know, they map out the entire story in advance. And then you have the gardeners who just kind of see, you know, what happens as they go along. Where would you put yourself in, like, which column?
So let me say first, well, even being in the same sentence as him is really awesome, so thank you for that. I'm more of a gardener. If people ask me what my rule of thumb is, I'm not a mapper, and I can't even handle my day job like that. But what I like to have is point A and point Z. Usually I have a pretty good sense of what the opening scene is going to look like and the last one, and I have some threads about how I'm going to get there, and then I just follow them. And I constantly try to remind myself what I wanted to do. And the story usually plays out. Now, I will admit, I'm extremely jealous of the, do you call them mappers? What's the phrase?
The architects.
Architects. I'm really jealous of the architects. I don't know if it makes a difference, but I love the idea that one could be an architect. And I have to admit, for the first time, I'm working on a sequel to a book. I wrote, as I mentioned, this book, Orphans in the Fall, and I wanted to do a sequel to it. And I kind of wanted to take a break during the summer, which I didn't really succeed at. But I sort of mapped out the sequel to it, and then I just allowed myself to fill in details. And what's funny is, first time I've ever tried it, and even as I'm doing other things, I knocked out like 100 pages because it's already laid out, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a funny thing. I think being an architect is probably a real gift. You know, on the other hand, it's funny with the book that just came out this week, Lost in Space. It's an essay collection. That is almost all Gardner. I mean, I just had a bunch of ideas I threw against the wall, and then I slowly peeled them off and thought, okay, that can be an essay, that can be an essay, but very unmapped out, extremely. And it's worked out fine, except that, you know, also the other thing is, when you're a gardener, probably especially, the editing, well, this is a supposition, but, you know, for me...
Yeah, editing seems like it would be a pain in the ass.
No, it's the opposite for me.
Oh.
Because as a gardener, one of my rules is that I never I never edit the first draft of something. Like, I might pick up on the last page and revisit it, but I write start to finish, even if it takes me 6 months. And so what comes in handy later as a gardener is you really have to go back and think about all the things you didn't plan out. Do you still like them? Do they still work? And again, because of this sort of Ramones approach, and, you know, I'm constantly stripping stuff out, even good stuff. Like, I always kill a significant chunk of backstory, which I should say is one of my other influences. I loved The Sopranos, and I loved how it was the first show I really remembered watching where the creator didn't seem to care if you didn't know everything that was going on. Like, he would just drop you in a scene. He might never give you any of the backstory. Mm-hmm. I love that. And so one of my goals when I edit is, like, weeding out, here's that gardener analogy again, I might take out half the backstory that's in there, and the other half I might turn into dialogue, and you're just going to have to deal. Hopefully it doesn't bother anybody. Of course, I don't have that many readers, so who knows. But, you know, that's a big thing to me.
I definitely agree with you. I'm more of a gardener as well. I also feel like it's kind of a little bit dangerous to your whole manuscript if you are more of an architect, because I've known a lot of people who, you know, they build like these grandiose, just huge, you know, ideas that they want to execute onto a page, and yet it completely loses any sort of excitement to it. You know, they lose interest in the project by planning everything out in advance. And to go back to like how the gardener works, you know, how I wrote my first book, Disorderly, was like exactly what you said. You know, point A and point Z. You got the beginning and the end figured out, and you just kind of go along. And I don't know, for me at least, that involved months of editing. You know, it got very sloppy. So I don't know. I there are definitely pros and cons to both, but I'm always interested to learn who likens himself closer to one more than the other.
Oh, yeah, it's a great question. It's a good question you haven't thought about. I've been thinking about it only recently because I thought I would try the other version, which has been fine. So I'm not remotely done, so I don't know what it's going to look like later. But I tried to do it. I'm not great at it. I even used some Post-its so I can move them around. So we'll see if that's real. It was different.
Yeah, it's always good to spice up your routine to try and keep the craft interesting for you.
Oh, yeah.
On that note, too, have you ever planned books in advance, or have you ever written two things at the same time? Me, personally, I have to focus on one particular project at a time. Otherwise, you know, the whole thing suffers. But do you work on two things at once, or, you know, do you come up with plans in advance, or...
Yeah, dude, that's a great question. So, you know, a friend of mine, Jason Fisk, who's a local writer, he and I had this running debate about whether writing involves even just the ruminating and sort of marinating on your ideas. I consider that something a writer does. I don't consider that actual writing. He does, so I'm fascinated by that. So I say that to answer your question because I'm usually plotting out a book in my head for up to a year before I start it. So usually I'm writing one thing and I'm plotting out the other. In the case of Orphans and Lost in Space, sort of, I wrote those back to back. I was thinking about Lost in Space constantly while I was writing and then editing Orphans. And then because of the timing, which is very unusual, I basically just transitioned from one to the other. You know, like, I never took a break. So there was some overlap. Another thing I'll do. So the biggest answer to your question is yes, totally. The other thing I'll do sometimes is I just feel like it's a good time to catch my breath on a particular thing that I've been sort of cranking, and maybe I haven't been breathing at all, and then I'm not sure if the breathing's needed. So, like, with Orphans, you know, I think I took off a month or two right in the middle of it to work on Lost in Space, you know, just to crank out some essays and change pace. And, you know, I'm a runner, too, and I'm not a good runner as far as training, but, you know, it's like anything else. Some days you're running hill, some days you're sprinting. I mean, I think there's some analogies there. So I will force myself to take breaks on the assumption that it serves a purpose. Whether it does, though, I don't always know if I have an answer to that.
What would you say is like the longest break you've ever taken between two different projects?
Oh, I don't know. 45 seconds? I don't know. I probably haven't really taken a break for the last 10 or 12 years. I think it's a combination of things, but no breaks at all. I mean, once in a while, I'll take off like a week to turn my brain back, you know, take a break. The closest I've come is this past summer into the fall. This is a new experience for me. I was feeling particularly manic. I was working on a couple of things at once, and I probably sound manic right now, so I shouldn't say I don't usually feel manic, but I was feeling especially manic. So I actually forced myself to take off like 2 weeks and not write at all. I felt like I just needed to calm my brain a little bit. And the funny part was,
you gotta cool off.
It didn't seem to be negative. I was thriving at work, and I was thriving with the writing, and you know, these things are coming out, so I know it all worked, but I got sort of like anxious about the feeling, and feeling like that all the time. So that's probably the first break I've really taken in the last 12, 15 years. And it was fine, you know, but I was glad when it was over.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about writing the whole time anyway, so it was just a little, calmer.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. You have to, you know, give yourself a cool off period now and again. So onto a different subject, you know, are you a fan of any of your contemporaries? There's a big online literary movement between, you know, alt-lit people, bizarro people, and they all kind of crowd around like the same type of environments and groups on Facebook particularly. But would you say you're a fan of any of your contemporaries right now, or have any, you know, recent books captivated your interest to the point where you're like, wow, all right, that's impressive?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and you should know if you haven't picked up on it. I mean, I'm an insane fanboy. So, yeah, I'm fans of so many writers, and some of them I know personally, and that's great. But you know, a lot of local writers. Obviously, Chicago is super ripe right now, and there's some guys who are not as well known. The bad stuff coming out recently. I love a friend of mine, Jason Fisk, and Pete Anderson. Other authors who are probably bigger. No offense to those guys. Sam Irby, whose essay collection Needy came out this past fall, which is just, I don't know, man. I don't know how every single person in the world's not reading it. It's phenomenal. Zero Fade by Chris Terry. Don't Start Me Talking by Tom Williams. I actually think Tom Williams is one of our honestly great American writers, period. I'm a fan, but he's terrific. And there's guys who I haven't seen as much recently, but I love them. Scott McClanahan, who I know everyone talks about and they should talk about.
I have him coming on the show.
Did you have him on the show?
Yeah, in a couple of months, actually. He sent me an email to do an interview, so we're going to have him on, I think, in June. So that should be fun.
Just better. Great dude, just a great fucking guy. And it's funny because he's gotten so popular, sometimes I worry he's going to overshadow how honestly good he is. And he's terrific. Paula Boehmer, Dave Housley. I love Dave Housley. I mean, there's a lot of people. I'm a bad person to ask that question. I am really, really, really a fan of writers. And, you know, I really devour books. I'm probably leaving out 10 people I could tell you I love, and I hope I didn't offend anyone. I should add, too, you know, on the side, I took some work with Curbside Splendor, and so I'm very biased towards our authors, several of whom I just mentioned, Sam Irby and Chris Terry and Tom Williams, so that might be suspect. I should put Megan Steelster in the mix, who I love. She's an essay writer also, just terrific. That's the other thing. I read a lot of fiction, but I love personal essays.
Oh, yeah.
I could read those all day long. Yeah, it's a good time for writers. Maybe it's always a good time for writers, but it feels like a very good time right now.
Yeah, no, certainly. You know, I go back and forth of whether or not that's the case, or if, you know, I've just surrounded myself with so many literary people that it seems that way. But regardless, you know, there's a lot of great books that are coming out from independent presses, people who aren't getting as much recognition as they should be.
Yeah.
But I'm going to move on to your podcast. So you have your own show called This Podcast Will Change Your Life. That's a takeoff on your blog. This blog will change your life. You know, what made you decide to start a show up?
You know, so it was funny. There's probably a couple of layers to unpack there. One was I had interviewed some early podcasters in Chicago by request for a magazine called Bad at Sports. Bad at Sports has a huge following. They are an arts, you know, predominantly arts, artists, art shows. And I was so fascinated by what they were doing. And I thought, man, can anybody do that? Like, you know, I was really stunned. So part of it was just which is how I make a lot of decisions. It was a very visceral reaction to hanging out with them and wanting to sort of feel like that, which just drives a lot of things I do. But I also had always really, really wanted to get to better know writers. I didn't know any. You know, I didn't even get an MFA. I went to social work school. So to me, it was also a way to figure out how to get into this universe. And then I think the last part of it was, I always had this fantasy that I would be in a position to maybe help other writers and artists if I ever got more established. That seemed like it would be fun. I had that fantasy even before I had the option to do it. So a podcast seemed like a very natural means for both entertaining myself, which I wanted to do, meet writers, which I wanted to do, and hopefully celebrate people who aren't as well known. Like, it's funny, I had Scott, as example, on the podcast probably 5 years ago. He wasn't quite who he is now. I mean, and so it's pretty funny. He was still sort of unknown, and I love him, and I love him the best. But, you know, I'd love talking to him. You could tell he was going to be great, you know? and I just we stumbled into it. So that's been a gift, and that was one of the reasons I always wanted to do it. Hype people, have fun, meet writers, so it's really worked out. I mean, it's a tool for just achieving some of the things I wanted to do.
Yeah, it's a great way to network, get to know people. You're kind of forced into like a weird situation where you have to get to know each other, and you can't often do that on, like, say, Facebook, or, you know, you can have conversations, of course, but I don't know. There's just something a little bit more intimate about being able to actually have a discussion about someone and talk about genuine interests.
No, absolutely. And to the extent I can, I try to do them all in person. And many of the early ones, which has changed probably for the better, was usually in bars or leaving bars. And so those are very intimate and, you know, borderline inappropriate. But, you know, fun for me, hopefully for them.
Why don't we move on to your latest book, which is Lost in Space. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about that?
Sure. So Victor Duran, the founder of Curbside Splendor, I don't really write a lot of nonfiction, their personal essays, though I love reading them. You know, we were doing this book, Meaty, by Sam Irby, which I really can't stress enough how wonderful it is. And, you know, he and I have some maybe minor disagreement about this. But, you know, my memory is we were at a bar. We had talked about doing something nonfiction before. And he said, you know, dude, he's coming out. And here you got this young, sexy woman talking about her illnesses and her dating life and her dead parents. You know, maybe we could have sort of a boring dad type version to bookend her collection. So I'm not sure if that's a real sales pitch, but that was all I needed. And, you know, I think he really wanted me to explore sort of my relationship, not necessarily with my children, but to parenting and being a parent and a writer and a, you know, 9-to-5 worker. And so that was the start. And then I just said, you know, when do we need that by? And he gave me a date. And, you know, I had done some stuff once in a while about my kids, but over the next year, which is about a year ago, one of the things I did was anytime anyone asked me to write, and when I get requests on occasion, if they let me write about my kids, I would turn it into an essay. So I slowly built out. My goal was to get to 20 essays. And then I decided later I wanted 20 essays and 4 sort of like comic interludes, sort of Chuck Klosterman-like, who, by the way, is another inspiration. You asked about inspirations earlier. I love Chuck Klosterman's use of pop culture and humor.
He's great, yeah.
You know, I set a goal of 20 pieces. You know, that was the main thing. And then over the year, kept thinking about what those pieces should look like. And it was a really interesting experience for me, you know, because I didn't want to tell my children secrets. That was a big deal to me. So I was very focused on that. I really wanted a mix of humor and pain. I really wanted that. You know, I didn't want to repeat things. It's so easy for every single essay to end with, and now I have to let my baby go. So, you know, you can't do that. And the final edit, which was fascinating, which was more not a rule, the first thing I was very conscious of, but, you know, the last thing I had to look back on was, are the essays about looking at the world as a parent or about to become a parent, or just the author, me, just going through life, and that's the stage of life you're in? And some of the pieces were more about, this is the stage I'm life in, and hey, maybe someday I'll be a parent. And so I actually ended up editing a handful of those pieces to be more real time. Like, I'm in the middle of this, and I may not be a parent yet, but I'm thinking about it. So, again, 20 essays, really trying to look at things. I mean, some of it sounds cliche, but hopefully they're fun. I mean, and interesting. And, you know, first haircuts is one of the essays is the first haircut one, which has been generating a lot of tears, which I was not expecting when I read it out loud.
On paper, that doesn't sound like too sad of a story. Yeah,
I think the edit made it something else. You know, originally it was kind of like my baby's getting his haircut. Look at that beautiful face. He's a little boy. But, you know, again, I could write that every essay. So I went with that one in particular. I went back and I thought, what's really painful about this? What I realized was, you know, I want my kid to be a superhero. You know, if I cut his hair, is he not going to be a superhero? What if he loses his powers to save the universe? You know, but then I realized wanting a kid as a superhero, very hit or miss, but wanting a kid to be kind and curious and be a good parent, that's a good thing. And so that's why I think it generates so many tears now. But, you know, I riff on everything. I riff on the boys' penises and my obsession. I'm not generally obsessed with penises, but I'm very obsessed with theirs, which is terrible. You know, I riff on the vasectomy I've never had. I riff on the Newtown shooting, which is not remotely humorous, but had to talk to my kids about it, just like I had to talk to them about sex. And, you know, also this idea that you're talking to your children about things that maybe your parents never talked to you about. I never had a sex talk, but I had to have one, you know, as an adult.
Right.
And, you know, I'm not even very good at it. So, it, you know, which isn't an issue when you're talking to an 8-year-old, but it's on your mind.
Of course.
So,
yeah.
You know, I tried to capture all of that. I tried to create this sense of a through line. And, you know, really, they're characters. I mean, I think it's very much a being in my head. What I hope, of course, is that you don't have to be a parent to relate to these things, you know, feeling bullied, feeling like an outsider, maybe having your own parent that's dead. I mean, also my father passed away about 13 years ago, and so he's really a looming presence. You know, he's someone who we have an incomplete relationship in some ways, and he never got to meet his grandkids, which I can't, you know, which I can't believe. So those are the things I was trying to work with. But again, as a gardener, as you said earlier, not as an architect.
It definitely sounds like you've been able to strike a chord with people emotionally. And that's definitely like one of the main things you strive for as a writer. So it sounds like you definitely accomplished your goal, even if, you know, certain things were not as exactly received as you expected them to be. Like, for example, you know, tears coming over a humorous story. But, you know, big congrats over that. That's pretty great.
It seems like a good thing. It seems like it's good for drawing people in. I mean, I'm thrilled about it. I think I'm more just surprised that that's what it sounds like. And that's good. Yeah, definitely not a complaint.
Yeah, that's awesome. So are you working on anything at the moment? I know you mentioned that you were working on a sequel to Orphan. So is that like your next thing that's coming out? Or do you have anything smaller or, you know, what have
well,
you?
Well, I'm really excited. In part of my manic phase last year, I worked on a flash fiction collection, which was new to me. I thought it'd be an interesting challenge. And it's part of a collection coming out later in towards summer around Father's Day, sort of a four fathers collection. And by the way, the funny part too is I have not consciously been thinking I want to write about dad issues, but I'm definitely in the middle of it. So that particular collection, which is coming out from Cobalt Press, I did flash fiction. This author I mentioned earlier, Tom Williams, is part of it. Dave Housley and a poet, B.L. Pavelek. Anyway, that's in the editing, or that's already getting ready to head to the press. So that's very, very obnoxious. But that's been done, you know, for about a year. And I'm working on this sequel to Orphans, and have been working on a novel also about a teenage girl drug dealer from a small town. I mean, I feel like I was writing a lot about men, and I thought I should sort of shift gears. So I've been working on my teenage girl story. So maybe not quite YA. There may be too many drugs and sex, but actually not that much sex, but trying to sort of capture it in that headspace. And, you know, that's been really interesting for, I mean, that was great. That's been a lot of fun. So, you know, always working on a bunch of things. Very obnoxious of me, for sure.
I'm almost somewhat intimidated to take on a story with the perspective or the main character being a female, because I don't know. I just, like, I can't really get into that headspace, and I feel like I would screw it up too badly that, you know, it would turn readers away. But that's definitely something I'm interested in doing in the not-so-distant future, is being able to conquer that, so to speak, and work around a different character that doesn't happen to be, you know, a white male like myself.
Yeah, and I think it's important. It's not necessary, but it's interesting. I really enjoyed it. You know, at every step, too, I'd have to say to myself, is that what a 15-year-old girl would say or do? And then I would try to remember what it was like to hang, not to be a 15-year-old girl, but to hang out with those women. And I always said I was an athlete, so I always hung out with lots of women because we always hung out, you know, and those women, I got along great with it. Well, they'd have to weigh in on that. But, you know, I did have some insight at those early ages. And so hopefully, you know, you try to draw, and I try to draw that, the things we talked about, the things they were dealing with. And, you know, it's been a very, it's been more than an exercise, but hopefully it's something that's productive and cool.
Why don't we move on to listener questions? Now, I've never had listener questions before, but we actually have a couple for you.
That's awesome.
Flight by Night asked, have you ever learned anything from one of your characters?
Wow, what a terrific question. I mean, yes, for sure. You know, I mean, one of the experiences I have had in trying to, you know, get, you know, I should say too, you know, I'm really, everything I write, it tends to be in the character's head, you know, which is at least partially in my head. So it's a great question. You know, I wrote a book, which was a riff on trying to think through when my father died and what it would be called My Father's House. And, you know, to think about what it would be like if I didn't behave like I behaved, you know. And, you know, I've learned, one thing I've learned a lot of with the writing, which I learned from characters like that character who's nothing like me but had a similar experience, that, you know, I'm incredibly rigid. I don't know if that's a particularly insightful thing, but, you know, I am very rigid day to day. You know, I am very rule bound, and I try to follow what I think is prescribed, and I try not to embarrass myself or my family or the people I work with. And, you know, with my characters, I give them a little more freedom. And, you know, one thing I've really realized, is that I probably sound like that the way I talk about writing other things. Like, I don't give myself a lot of those permissions. I mean, the upside of that has been, you know, a work life, which I'm excited about, and, you know, a family life, which I love, and being able to write and doing all of it. But, you know, the characters are more relaxed. That'd be one thing. You know, the other thing, which is, it's almost like a humble brag, but of course, in writing Lost in Space, the Father collection, and an earlier shorter essay collection I did called 99 Problems, which was sort of about the intersection of writing and running, I really have learned a lot about myself writing about myself, which again, sounds like a real humble brag, but you know, it's a funny thing to see yourself on paper and to realize things, you know, realize how not in touch I have been with my emotions, you know, that parenting, yeah. For example, parenting has put me in touch with things I never felt before. Insane rage, insane love. And here I've been in a happy marriage for a long time, but you know, nothing like the kids. And with the running, you know, how much suffering there is, how much pain I'm in all the time, which I didn't realize, how much my knees hurt and my back hurts, which I sort of know. But anyway, that's, I think between the nonfiction and the fiction, it really has given me a lot of insight in how I operate day to day. And some of it's sort of embarrassing to me, and some of it is like, okay, it's better to know that now. It's a really good question. I appreciate it.
I've never even thought of something like that before until I got this question also. You know, that was definitely a really interesting one. So good on you, Flight by Night.
Yeah, man, or ma'am.
Yeah, we have no clue. The following three questions are actually from anonymous. I apparently don't have an account with the website that we got these in. So, who do you think is the most overrated author?
Wow, that's such a terrible question, isn't it? How do I avoid answering that? You know, it's funny.
You don't like a little mudslinging?
No, I hate mudslinging. Yeah, no, I hate mudslinging. Let's think of a better way to answer that.
I think you're better off just answering someone who's dead.
I know, right? I know.
But go with Hemingway or Twain. I don't know.
I do love Hemingway quite a bit. Let's think. Who's overrated? I'm going to really think about this for a second. I think it's a good, appropriate question. Okay, here's what I'm going to say. I know people. I mean, I think he's probably considered the greatest writer in one of the greatest writers in history, but I must admit, don't totally get the James Joyce thing. Is that wrong?
No, I'm not against your opinion there.
It's like, I have to say, for me personally, it's too thick. And it's not an issue of reading long books, because, you know, I will read anything. But it's a lot of parsing to get to the enjoyment. And maybe that's part of it. Maybe I'm unwilling to do all the work. But that's one. Mm-hmm. I think that's one. I mean, I've really tried, and I got to say, I don't totally get it. I want someone to explain it to me, though. I mean, one thing, you know, you can convince me of anything, so I'm probably wrong, and I'd love to hear someone tell me why I'm so completely wrong about him.
I'm not a big fan of James Joyce either, but I don't know. To each their own, I guess.
All right, dude, you're hooking me up. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Next question, again from Anonymous. Has Ben ever stopped writing a book or had to start over a book entirely just because it was bad?
Wow, that's a great question. So, I think my ego is too big to accept the fact that I would write something so bad I would ditch it. But it's a great question because, you know, my father's house, which came out about a year or so, 2 years ago, initially was written as a memoir based on the diaries I kept as my dad was sick and I was following him around the country. And, you know, as a memoir, I liked it a lot. And actually, it got some really nice rejection letters. A lot of it was just like, someone someday is going to write the really funny, interesting dead memoir, but we're not ready for it. Or there's too many death memoirs right now. So I really put it aside, which was so painful for me. And then about 2 years ago, I was out running, or 3 years ago, and I thought, maybe the limitations of that book are the limitations of nonfiction. You know, maybe what I need to do is to blow up that lead character. And when I did that, it became a novel later. So that is one I set aside. It's the only time I've done it. I set it aside for several years. And then one day I was out running. It was really late at night. And I saw the whole book differently, and I tore it apart. So, yeah, I did. I didn't think it was bad, though, so I'm sort of hedging. I apologize. But it definitely seemed unfixable as a memoir. Like, I couldn't figure out what people wanted, especially since they were all positive. So, you know, that one I just set aside and came back years later and I saw it differently and I ran with it.
So another anonymous user asked, where did Ben get the idea for Orphans?
Wow, I love all these questions. So here I'm going to sound again like I'm repeating myself. So I was out running late
at night. You seem to do that a lot.
I know. Well, I do. I mean, I run almost every day, and I write almost every day, so they intersect quite a bit. But I was out running. It was late. It was beautiful out. And I got, I don't know why, at this part I don't know, but this idea popped to my head, like, wouldn't it be cool to write something about a father and a son if the father was like a salesman? And I started thinking about Death of a Salesman, which I guess is pretty pretentious. Like, what would it look like to write a Death of a Salesman? That's what I was teasing in my head. And then I thought, you know, that could be a good idea, but how do I not repeat myself since I tend to write about men anyway and men who work? And then I thought, maybe the difference could be this guy is a salesman in the future. And then I thought, maybe he sells property on Mars. Like, that's how my head started spinning. I go, so maybe it's more like a mashup of Glengarry, Glenn Ross, and the Martian Chronicles. And that's where it started. And then it just took off. And then I was off and, again, off and running. It sounds so bad. Anyway, after I didn't write it for about a year, but that's where it started. And once I had that idea in my head, then it was just a matter of sitting down and finishing whatever I was already doing. But that's how it started, literally thinking about dads and sons and work and Mars.
Very cool. Orphans has gotten a lot of praise, I've seen, and quite a bit of press, too. That's actually how I first heard of you. I think I read a review of your book. I definitely have to check that out. I got to add it to my reading queue.
I'd appreciate that. Yeah, I definitely was very consciously trying to mess with genres because, you know, again, if you're gonna try to write all the time, which I do, I really don't want to tell the same story again and again, if I can avoid it, you know?
Yeah. I'm not a big sci-fi guy, and it doesn't seem like you are either, but that definitely sounds interesting to me, so I'll have to check that out soon.
I would appreciate that.
I think we're going to wrap up here. Do you have any plugs? Do you want to shout out your Twitter, your website, anything?
I want to thank you, sure. You know, I really use my blog as sort of the mothership, bentanter.blogspot.com. I am very active on social media. I find it very entertaining. I probably would not use it at all if the books weren't coming out, but, you know, the handle on Twitter is at Ben Tanzer. I'm thrilled to hear from people and take questions and talk about books. Dude, I really appreciate you doing this. I want to give a shout out to Kirkside Splendor, the Chicago publisher I help out, and who is putting out Lost in Space. I definitely want people to read Lost in Space. That would be really cool of you. And I don't know, man. Otherwise, thanks so much for this. It's really been a pleasure.
Not a problem. It's been great chatting with you. Best of luck with Lost in Space. Hopefully it does well in the sales. And again, thanks again. Take care.
Oh, thanks, brother. I really appreciate it.
And that was Ben Tanzer, author of Lost in Space and Orphans. Check out his books. You can buy them on Amazon. You can buy any book on Amazon. Very chatty guy. That was great. All right. That's a wrap. Boop.
3501, 2, 5, go! I was there in the backstage when this light came around. I grew up not a changeling, but when the first time around, I could see all the weakness, I could pick all the faults, but I could see all the faintness, just a stick in your throat. Pay what you. Pay what you.